Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're recording our show on this Thursday night at Legacy Hall at the River Center in Columbus, Georgia. This is a beautiful, beautiful theater, and we have a beautiful live audience here to watch the show tonight, and we're so glad you're all here. For those of you out there who are watching tonight on Facebook Live, we welcome you. We're glad to have you with us. If you're listening to the show on Friday afternoon, our regular time slot, you won't find us on Facebook Live because we're not. But we have plenty to talk about. Most of the stories we'll discuss tonight will certainly resonate throughout the news cycle tomorrow. So let me introduce the panel who we're going to be talking with tonight. First of all, let's do it in order of length of service. We have with us State Representative Calvin Smyrie, Democrat from Columbus, the longest serving member of the Georgia General Assembly. How many years, Calvin?
44.
All right.
Sitting next to him, you know that she's a semi-regular panelist on Political Rewind, and it's because she invited us that we're here in Columbus doing the show. Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson. Hi.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here. Thank you all.
We also are really fortunate to have with us State Senator Josh McCoon. Thank you for being here, Josh. You've been a panelist on Political Rewind before, and we're glad to have you back tonight.
Thank you, Bill.
And for those of you who listen to the show regularly, you've heard me say that Galloway couldn't be here because he's went to see Hamilton as we're taping this show on Thursday night. But fortunately, we have in his place a veteran of the Columbus news business from The Ledger, Chuck Williams. Thank you for being here, Chuck. So let's get started. We know the governor's race is certainly well underway, and because we're here, Chuck, I want to get a sense of where you see this race from the people you talk to in the community. Let's talk about how this race seems to be unfolding here. So, if we can, what's going on with Kemp and Cagle down this way?
You know, it's really interesting because if you look at it, and I was talking to a Democratic strategist who's on the national scene, and we were kind of talking about the governor's race and about Abrams kind of waiting for the winner of this. And one of the things this person told me was, this isn't your granddaddy's Georgia. And I was trying to kind of put my arms around it. And then the way this person explained it to me was, the people who are dying in our state, and I've lived here for 15 years now, so I'm going to call it my state. The people who are dying in the state are older and white. The people who are moving into this state are younger. Most of them are college educated, coming in to tech jobs, movie industry jobs. There is a growing and a more affluent African-American community, mostly based out of Atlanta. It's becoming a very different state. Will you see that transition in this election? I mean, who knows? But it is becoming a different place. And if you go to the Cagle-Kemp runoff, one of the things interesting to me, Casey got 47% of the vote in Muskogee County in the Republican primary. But Kemp only got 11% down.
He came in third
to
Hunter Hill.
To Hunter Hill, yeah. And the interesting part is Hunter Hill was as close as we had to a local candidate. He's on the board of the National Infantry Museum. He's a U.S. Army Ranger. He has ties in this community with institutions and people. So I wasn't surprised to see Hunter do well here, but I think where did that 26% go? You know, but that's not going to decide it. I mean, it's going to be decided far outside these boundaries.
Josh, I saw you nodding about the Brian Kemp showing in this county. Have you declared a candidate you've supported?
I have not.
Ah, very wise. Where do you think this race is headed?
I think that, I mean, there are two schools of thought when you talk to Republicans about this. One is that the lieutenant governor had a significant lead on primary night, and that if the turnout is similar, he'll be able to get over 50% relatively easily. There are other people that say, well, he's got, you know, very high name identification comparative to all the other candidates. Is there a ceiling there? And do the folks that were for folks like Hunter Hill, do they come back out specifically to vote for Kemp? And, of course, we've seen, you just have to go back to 2010, Karen Handel was far ahead in the first round in 2010. And then, of course, Governor Deal came back and was able to narrowly edge her out in the runoff. So it's not unusual for someone to be down even double digits in that first round and come back.
So, Calvin, Teresa, are there issues down here that you think are different from what voters in the rest of the state are going to decide this election on? Calvin?
Well, I think that and as it relates to the gubernatorial campaign, I noticed that Stacey Abrams has been talking about more about job opportunities and industries and creating more opportunities for small businesses. And I think those types of issues resonate at the breakfast table. And I think if we continue to do that, you attract a much larger path of voters. And I think if she continues to go in that direction, I think it bodes well for the Democratic nominee and for the down ballot candidates as well.
Yeah.
Teresa?
Let me give a quick shout out to our mayor-elect Skip Henderson, who's in the front row.
I'm sorry, I should have done that in the beginning.
And we're so glad to have him here, 22-year veteran of the Columbus Council, so we're going to be in good hands. But Columbus is a true blue county, as you know, and so we're a minority-majority community. This is Democratic country. When we have gubernatorial elections, the Democrat will carry it usually 60%. There's a few anomalies. And so it doesn't surprise me that Cagle, was quite a bit ahead and Kemp behind. And then, of course, Hill with his military connections doing fairly well here. I think you're going to get a little moderated, perhaps even in the Republican balloting here. But Columbus is part of that black belt, reference to the soil, not the skin. People make that mistake all the time. And so this is a strong blue stretch that goes through central Georgia. And I can say, you know, there was a poll done in the fall at the University of Georgia did a poll that shows that South Georgia is pretty much going to be Democrat now. That has to do a lot with population fluctuations, the depopulation of South Georgia in some instances, a lot of population growth in North Georgia. But that's a serious dynamic change for Georgia. And so I think you're going to see Stacey Abrams changing the game. First of all, she's a very authentic progressive. She's not a Republican light. She's not embarrassed to be a Democrat. She's very strong in her opinions and very confident. And so you don't get that hint of fear that maybe some Democrats have had in the past.
So let's help our listeners and me understand this. Chuck, I mentioned at the very top of the show that Drew Ferguson is, of course, like all members of Congress, up for re-election, of the House, up for re-election. And he seems to be perhaps safe. We're going to talk more specifically about his race in a minute. But in the meantime, help our listeners understand. Mayor Tomlinson, of course, says that Columbus is true blue. We know that's the case. How does that third district overlay Columbus, and where do all the Republicans come from?
There's a north-south boundary here. I mean, I know there are people in the community that cringe when you say that, but there's a north-south boundary. And if you look, the way there are two congressional districts that touch Columbus, Georgia's third and Georgia's second. And the results of them are essentially baked in. I mean, the north is predominantly Republican. The south to the east is predominantly Democrat. I mean, it is what it is when you look at that.
All right, I want to go back to the Republicans for a minute, Josh. The Kemp campaign a while ago, and we've talked about this on Rewind, put out results of an internal poll. We always know when you're promoting an internal poll that you're obviously promoting numbers that are beneficial to you, showing it as a neck-and-neck race. In talking to some of the Cagle people today, they tell me their internal polling now shows this race really moving toward Casey, and they say it's because they think their attacks on Kemp have had a big impact. And some of you have seen the TV commercial. Really a tough spot. Does Kemp have any money to combat this? He seems to have he doesn't seem to be able to respond at this point. And what's that going to do to him?
Yeah, I think you've hit on the central question of the race, which is, can he compete on the airwaves? And I think we're still waiting to see. Obviously, we've got a 9-week runoff process. He probably needs to be on television certainly by the end of this month.
It seems to me the minute Casey Cagle put out his spot, what was it, incompetent and unqualified?
Right. Well, I think what you're going to see, first of all, Kemp is, I think, being cast as the more conservative, Cagle more establishment Republican. And you're going to have some pretty ardent, very conservative voters coming out. There's going to be very low turnout. So I think all bets are off. I think Kemp might get a bounce just from that, having the more conservative, more rural folks coming out, which is where he did very, very well. I will say that the race is now ripe for surprises. We saw one just before we went on the air. There's been some sort of a tape that the Tippins campaign or camp released. And that's the type of thing you're going to see when you have a heated 9-week runoff. And so it's going to get tough out there, and anything can happen when you're talking about that low of a turnout.
Yeah. Kelvin, why don't you just go ahead? I didn't ask you a question. Weigh in.
Well, I think that the election on the Republican side is for Kemp to lose. I mean, he has all of the things going for him at this time. He has the funds, and when you have the funds to
Cagle's,
you
to
mean
lose.
Cagle's.
I mean Cagle. It's Cagle to lose because Cagle has the necessary funds. And when you're not able to respond back to a negative ad, it has a positions the way it positioned the voters. So I think with that in mind, I reflect back to 2003, and for the first time, the Democrats were very, very competitive with the Republican votes, as it was with the Democratic votes statewide, which means, therefore, we keep an energized base and have our message, and we've got an articulate candidate who knows the issues, who can really talk about the issues, and she knows the issues that resonate with voters. I've served with her. Representative Hugler, who's here tonight, has served with her, and we know what she's capable of. So the opportunities are out there, and the only thing now, we don't need to find out who is our opponent.
Yeah.
Josh, you sent me a really interesting question, I thought. You pointed out that Calvin Smyre was chairman of the party in 2002, when the red wave suddenly engulfed the governor's office, all the state constitutional offices, the legislature. Roy Barnes lost his second term to Sonny Perdue, and things haven't changed. And you said you were interested in knowing, is this a wave election coming up as well? I can ask Calvin, but I'd be interested in your reaction, your thoughts.
Well, obviously, you see in the primary turnout numbers, 2010, 680,000 Republicans vote in the Republican primary for governor. This year, 605. Democratic primary numbers were way up, I think 550,000, something in that neighborhood. So all of that tends to suggest a much more competitive general election environment, in my opinion. Obviously you get race by race. What do the Democrats versus the Republicans do? I think in the gubernatorial race, whoever the Republican nominee is, I think what they're going to point out is that on a lot of the signature issues of the last 8 years, whether it be HOPE reform, the Transportation Investment Act in 2015, Leader Abrams was right there in the mix and part of that solution. So where do you get the separation from what Republicans have done over the last 8 years?
Are you ready to endorse her, Josh?
No.
It sounds like you like her.
I think it makes for a very interesting general election dynamic.
You know I'm kidding. Chuck, your take on all that before we move on.
I think the general elections will be very interesting. And one of the things that surprised me in the Democratic primary, and I live downtown within walking distance of this building, and I was surprised by the number of yard signs for Stacey Abrams that I saw in the yards of whites. I mean, in the primary. I mean, they staked Stacey Abrams out very early against a qualified candidate in Stacey Evans. So it surprised me, and it had me thinking, what's going on here? Because if you look, and some of them are in this audience now, some of the neighbors, they had already gotten on Abrams' team very early, and they were very vocal about it. And I think that And I'm wondering if that was happening in Macon, in Augusta, in Atlanta.
Yeah. Can I just add to that before we leave? There were 240,000 votes that came in to vote Democrat that were a differential from prior elections. And who were those people? Maybe some of those we yanked out of bed and said, go vote. That's a lot of folks. And I think what you're going to see, I truly believe the wild card is white, moderate, independent, and perhaps moderate liberal Republicans were coming over. And the other thing that was interesting when you look down the ballot is that women were winning every race. It's almost like people were going to the polls and saying, I'm voting for women for a change. And I will say that is consistent. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll came out today that showed that same kind of trend, that people are coming out and just voting for what they believe will be a check on things they have concerns about, whether it's Donald Trump or whatever. But that, and they're picking women.
You know, that poll was interesting, Calvin. I don't know that you've had a chance to see it, but one of the things that the poll found was, first of all, that President Trump's approval rating is moving up, but it's moving up among his base. Mm-hmm. It's not broadening, it's deepening.
Yeah.
The people who support him are supporting him more than ever. But the other thing that was interesting is that asked the question of whether they would vote to block Trump or to support Trump, a healthy majority said they'd vote to block him. Mm-hmm. So it's really an interesting dynamic.
I have a theory that people look nationally, but they vote locally. They have a tendency to measure the political instincts of the various candidates, and they have a tendency to vote in that fashion. And in my opinion, in 2003, when we lost the governor's race, we didn't lose the House. We had party switches that gave the Republicans the House. They didn't win the House. They had about 15 to 16 Democrats that saw the wave coming.
You could feel the fear sweep through the House.
It. And I think that's what's happening. There's a strong dynamic occurring in our state, and I think Chuck Williams hit it on the head. There's a new voter, there's a new constituent, and the pendulum is swinging. And I think so goes the pendulum, so goes the political wind, so goes, I think, Democratic victories. And another key to me is, and Stacey Abrams expressed this to me, that we're going to have a coordinated campaign. To me, that really strengthens of the party as it relates to not only governor, but down about to state reps and otherwise.
I mean, to Calvin's point, I want to ask Calvin a question because I'm curious here. In 2002, Governor Barnes got hit by a school bus. I mean, the teachers took him out. If you listen to
as much as the flag.
And the flag.
For sure.
And the flag.
But is there an issue in this election that is similar to what happened to Governor Barnes in 2002?
I think that was a situation where, you know, it's something that caught on. I think in this instance, I think it's going to require issues that wins the day. I don't think there's anything, there's no magic wand out there for either side to win. I think it's going to take issues.
But, you know, with that in mind, Josh, I think
Casey, a strong message.
I'm sorry. Did you want
to? And a strong message.
I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting. I watched Cagle running in the primary. Sure, he was on the attack at times, but he also did have a positive message about economic development. So maybe Calvin, that proves the point. That, of course, you're going to have to attack your opponent, but maybe voters here really do want to hear messages about growth and about what we're going to do to make the state better.
Well, I think what does make Lieutenant Governor Cagle a formidable general election nominee for the Republican Party, if he is the nominee, is that he can claim Governor Deal's legacy and say, you know, this is a state that has been voted the number one state to do business for the last 5 or 6 years. This is one of a handful of states around the country that has maintained its AAA bond rating. This is a state that this year fully funded K-12 public education to the QBE funding formula. I mean, there are a lot of things he can say. Look, I'm the competent manager that can keep everything in the middle of the road. And the question is, to the point that I think Chuck was making, what is the lightning rod issue that creates a separation there for Leader Abrams to take advantage of?
Do you see one?
I mean, I'm hard-pressed at this point to identify one. I think that the economy is very strong. I think people feel good about where they are. They generally feel good about the direction of the state. If you look at the polling for the last several months about right track, wrong track for Georgia, there's generally the right track has a strong majority. So not that that couldn't change. The one other thing I would say about the primary data, and I do agree that there's something going on there, but I think it needs to be noted in the 6th and 7th congressional districts, Democrats had, for the first time in quite some time, competitive primaries. Both of those were multi-candidate races that have gone to runoffs, and that does account for some of the growth in the numbers.
All right. Josh McCoon, you get the final word in the first segment because we got to get to a break. We'll come back. We have a lot more to talk about here at the Legacy Center, at the Legacy Hall at the River Center in Columbus, Georgia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're here at Legacy Hall at the River Center in Columbus, Georgia. This is a gorgeous facility. Not only Legacy Hall itself, but the 2,000-seat theater next door. If you have not seen it in Columbus, y'all really should come down. And Kelvin Smyrie, you know, one of the leaders of the Georgia House for many years, you had a role along with Governor Barnes, we just talked about, and a few other legislators in making this a reality.
Yeah. Thank you, and Representative Hughley and all the members of the Columbus delegation worked for 9 years to get this center developed, and it's one of the jewels of Columbus, Georgia, and we're proud of it, and Governor Barnes and Governor Miller were instrumental along with the Board of Regents and Columbus State University, and this is part of our uptown explosion here in Columbus, and you can leave here and go all the way to Total Systems and activities between the two facilities.
Yeah, there's an amazing, Mayor Tomlinson, there's a lot of people who have not been down this way, and one of the things they're not aware of is that about, 7, 8 years ago, you had engineers come in, or you didn't specifically, but you as part of a team,
right.
to create the longest whitewater rapids rafting
urban
stretch.
Yeah, in
urban.
The world. It's 2.6
it runs right
miles
through downtown.
Right through the downtown of the city, which is just incredible. And then we have maybe a 4-block area where there's 22, 24 something bars and restaurants, most of them locally owned. It's just a phenomenal
That's
bustling
what we want.
Downtown.
People drinking and then going out on the river.
And then rafting. And we have an interstate zip line, so you can go from Georgia to Alabama on a zip line.
And I also wanted to mention, too, he's no longer in the legislature, but Tom Buck very, very instrumental because he was part of the budget committee that...
All right, as long as we're making announcements about ourselves here, talking about ourselves, I have been telling people on the air that we are going to have what we think is, for us, a significant announcement on Political Rewind. So what I want to share with you is that your response to the show, those of you who are here in Legacy Hall tonight and the listeners... or Facebook Live viewers across the state, you have responded with such enthusiasm about the show. You know, we started one day a week, then we went to two, now we're on three, and starting on the day before the runoff, July 23rd, we're gonna go to 4-day-a-week schedule. We'll be on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, and that little show, Two-Way Street, which is creative people talking about their work and their lives will continue at 2:00 on Thursday. So we love the support you've given us, and thank you for that. Let me go to an issue that has popped up on the radar screen. We all know, and it's very important here in Columbus, I think it's safe to say, Chuck, veterans issues matter here enormously. Johnny Isaacson, chairman of the VA committee, the Veteran Affairs Committee, has been passing a series of bills to improve veterans' services. And he's been remarkably successful working in a bipartisan manner to do most of this. The most recent measure that he passed, among other things, will expand the community care that veterans are going to be able to get outside VA facilities. It's controversial in many ways because a lot of veterans groups don't want the VA to be sort of pushed out of the picture. But the other day, in signing this bill, the president made a big deal of it in the Oval Office. Johnny was at his side, signed the measure. But we've now learned today that this bill is going to require an infusion of $50 billion, a lot of money.
$50
billion. $50 billion, and the White House is fighting it because they're already nervous about how much money they put into the last budget bill. They're trying to claw some of that back to help the conservatives in midterms. So now Isaacson can't get the money that he and his bipartisan group want for this thing.
When you look at Columbus, and we've got an amazing uptown, we've got a lot of great things in this city. Make no mistake about it, we are an Army town. Mm-hmm. This town depends on Fort Benning in the United States Army economically, both in talent. I mean, you got folks like Bob Portishev on the front rows, a former mayor of this town, mm-hmm. Carmen Cabeza, who was a city manager and a former CG at Benning. Mm-hmm. We depend on the leadership, the money and the experience that Fort Benning provides us. This military bill, and I communicated today with a friend of mine who's a retired command sergeant major, and top notch guy, and I sent him this and the article that you sent us to look at, and I said, what does this mean? And his first two words were care matters. And when you look at the vets that are committing suicide, you look at some of the issues that our military veterans are facing. I mean, they're significant and they're complex. Those things need to be addressed. And we have, 700,000 military retirees in Georgia. There are 34,000 in Columbus alone. And the closest VA hospital is an hour away in Tuskegee, Alabama. There are issues our vets face every single day. And what this does, as I understand it, is it allows them, with the backlog in the VA, to turn around and get into care at Columbus, at Piedmont Medical, or wherever. It allows them to go into the providers.
But there's a big price tag that comes with it.
$50 billion. And, you know, but it's important. It's really important in a community such as this.
So, Josh, you would call yourself one of the more conservative members, I think, of the legislature. Is that fair?
That's a fair statement.
So I wonder how you feel about this, what seems to be a dilemma that Republicans on the Hill are facing over this. There's this clear awareness or feeling among some of the conservatives up there that so much money was put into the big bill, big budget bill, that Republicans are going to have a hard time defending it. They seem like a party of spendthrifts. So now they're trying to claw back some of that. So now the White House, to appease the people who are scared about this, saying, well, we're going to have to find some other way to come up with that $50 billion. That's a dilemma, it seems to me, for Republicans, whether you're on the Hill or here in Georgia.
Well, I think Republicans, even conservative Republicans, feel like there are things that government ought to do. And one of the things that government ought to do, and it's in the Constitution, is to provide for our common defense. And when we ask people, because obviously we have an all-volunteer armed forces, when we ask people to sign up and to go into dangerous places and to sustain injuries, whether those are readily apparent physical injuries or there are other injuries that they sustain that affect their mental health, we need to stand behind them. And so whatever investment needs to be made, I think you're going to find at the end of the day the Republican caucus coming together and saying this needs to be a priority because, again, it is related to one of those baseline foundational purposes of the federal government.
Yeah, and let me break it down a little bit about what exactly is going on here. So what the White House has told the legislators is we're not going to give you a dime for this $50 billion. So you need to go to the veterans budget, and you need to figure out something you're going to cut if you want to make this happen. But now that's not the same thing for the wall. They're going to find somehow we're going to deficit spend the wall. And so I just want to say...
Well, it should be said they haven't found that money.
Right, they haven't yet found the money, but that's what the White House has said.
Okay.
And so, but I want to make this clear. So is patriotism measured by how tall you stand, whether or not you know the words to God Bless America, whether you put your hand over your heart, take a knee or whatever, or whether you take care of your veterans? So I think that might have something to do with patriotism. And just one other little... One other little observation is you know, you talked about Wednesday on Political Rewind. McConnell and Senator Perdue and some folks called, you know, they called off the recess because they want the Democrats who are disproportionately this time around standing for re-election in tighter races so they can't go home to campaign. And that's always a cute trick. Everybody does. I'm sure Democrats have done it in the past. Who knows? But in any event, so it's a cute trick. But here's what's going to happen. They're going to spend their summer trying to find $50 billion for veterans. And guess who is Johnny Isaacson's right hand on that committee but John Tester.
John Tester,
and so John Tester is going to be out there finding $50 billion, and it's going to come back to bite him. So when you're too cute by half, and you try to play these political games, and you leave veterans out there twisting in the wind, you're going to get what you asked for.
Kelvin?
Well, I really, as I watched the development on it, I think it's a sad commentary that you pass a VA bill and then you don't want to fund it.
Yeah.
To me, it's so hypocritical. I'm from a military family, and for the military, this is not even a tip on our debt
right.
in America. This is not a 15% tip. Mm-hmm. And here we are talking about $50 billion, and we are trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And I think it's an insult. Mm-hmm. to the military community and for all the families around America, for them to talk about not finding $50 billion. And I just hope and I pray that the moderate Democrat and the centrist Republicans will hold their feet to the fire and not give in, and that we can find three or four more Republicans to get to the magic number. Because to me, $50 billion for our veterans and for them to have adequate health care, it's a small payment to what the military has given to this nation.
Absolutely.
Josh and Chuck. So Isaacson, Johnny Isaacson isn't the kind of guy who butts heads with anybody, but he clearly is going to now have to figure out how to come to terms with the White House on some compromise on the funding. At the same time, Johnny Isaacson has taken a rather bold stand just today in terms of the president's imposition of a steel and aluminum tariffs. Isaacson has said quietly he opposes the tariffs. Today, he introduced legislation that will require congressional approval of any tariff levied on imports in the name of national mm-hmm. security, which is what the president and his people have said. This is a matter of national security. What is going on with Johnny Isaacson and President Trump, Josh?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, historically, the legislature had the taxing authority. And the idea that the executive branch can unilaterally impose taxes is a relatively recent phenomenon. I think you will find among many Republicans a desire
because Herbert Hoover imposed tariffs unilaterally, and then we had the Depression, I think it was called.
That's right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But there, and of course, that was after Congress gave away some of their authority. And so I think that you have a lot of Republicans, Senator Rand Paul, Senator Isaacson, Congresswoman Handel's talked about this, about reining in the executive authority to impose those tariffs. Now, I think as far as Senator Isaacson being able to maintain a good relationship with the White House, I think anybody that bets against that is making a losing bet, because he understands how that process works in Washington. He understands how to maintain relationships. And I think both he and Senator Perdue will continue to enjoy a very good relationship with the White House.
Chuck, you're not far from West Point here in Columbus, and there's manufacturing that could be affected by these tariffs. I mean, this region could be affected by these tariffs.
There's no question. I mean, you look at the Kia plant. There are an awful lot of Sorrentos rolling off the line 40 miles north of here, and a lot of people from Columbus to Newnan that have jobs that depend on that plant. You know, I mean, I'll say this about Senator Isaacson. And people who have underestimated what Senator Isaacson is doing or has done usually end up getting beat. Mm-hmm. Senator Isaacson's a very smart man. Mm-hmm. And he seems to, I mean, He has seen something that's leading him into this fight. He either he's being pushed by somebody behind, I mean, somebody else party, but there's a reason he's there.
Well, I mean, the Koch brothers have already said they're going to put up money to fight against the tariffs. So Johnny Isaacson, as Chuck really pointed out with Rand Paul and others, far from alone on the right in opposing the.
Yeah, Johnny Isaacson's dead right on this, and this doesn't make any economic sense. This isn't conservative policy. Let me say this. Wilbur Ross is not an economist. He's a major investor in the steel industry, the coal industry, and the auto industry. So, I'm not sure what exactly his motives are, but I can tell you this. That Article 1, Section 8, the very first power given, expressed for Congress, is that they shall set tariffs. And so that's why Donald Trump had to get the whole national security thing going. What exactly our national security threat is for Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, I guess is why President Trump referred to the War of 1812 yesterday, erroneously. But I think that's fine. We made it out of the War of 1812. And we've moved on, so I don't see Canada or the EU or Mexico as a national security threat. I do think we have to worry about the World Trade Organization smacking us around, perhaps our own courts. Some of these farmers may want to take up some suit, and that's an unfortunate thing, of course, particularly on the heels of the UN finding that the United States is violating human rights with DACA. But that's a whole nother, not DACA, but the folks seeking asylum at the border. But I'm just saying that there's nothing economically based in this. It's a fear-based strategy that's very unfortunate, and Johnny Isaacson is absolutely right to try to pull this back into Congress.
Calvin, Michael Thurman and Sam Olens, who are a great pair of duelers on our show every few weeks, were on Wednesday, and we talked about tariffs, and Mike Thurman made a very funny comment. He said, I long for the old Republican Party when they opposed tariffs.
I did owe with the mayor.
Tariffs don't do this state a whole lot of good,
no,
you would
sir.
Say, and
no,
obviously
sir.
The mayor thinks
If you're looking for a trade war, I know a lot of countries will give you one.
Yeah.
And it's not to our best interest from a national defense perspective, nor from an economic perspective. So I think Johnny Isaacson is onto something. And I agree that the appropriators and the members of the various committees of jurisdiction in Congress are supposed to be able to appropriate the funds that go to these representative or legislative initiatives. So hopefully they will stick to their guns and stand up, and nobody can break your back unless you bend it.
Josh McCoon, I want to take up a couple of issues that involve you, if you don't mind. I saw there was an interesting piece. I guess it was Mark Neisig in the AJC wrote a piece today. The headline of it was, "Opposition to Georgia Republican Legislative Agenda Comes from Within." So you're going to finish up your term as senator. You lost the race for Secretary of State, and I want to talk about that a little bit. But you said that there's not the same kind of energy or cohesion around the conservative bloc in the Georgia legislature. Is that mostly in the state Senate seems to be cohesive as a conservative group, as we see with, say, the Freedom Caucus in Washington. Tell us more about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, so Mark's question to me was about how do individual members wield authority? And of course, it's kind of funny being the number 7 person that voted no. The other way you can look at it, I voted yes about 83% of the time. So there's some movement in those numbers. But in terms of the state government, our governor is so much more powerful in our system than the president is at the federal level. Our system, basically, you have 3 people setting the legislative agenda. You have the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the House, and the governor. And so even if you can get 10, 12, 15 senators together maybe on an individual issue, there are so many levers to work those members and to move them from no to yes I don't think you're ever going to see a structure like the Freedom Caucus at the federal level in Georgia state government.
Which maybe, Chuck, is why at times Josh McCoon got so frustrated, he picked fights with powerful people like, the Speaker of the House, for example.
I think I may have written about that. You're laughing, Calvin. Want to do reporting on that right now? You know, it's interesting because Josh nailed it when he said the power of the governor. And as Calvin knows, I mean, one of the things, when you look at Calvin, 44 years, 22 elections, he's probably the most resilient politician you'll ever meet.
And probably one of the most respected regardless of political affiliation.
But he's, I mean, and I'm not blowing smoke, I'm just saying that Calvin has figured out a way with his party out of power to remain relevant. That's not an easy thing to do. But when you go to the governor's power, and I had a friend of mine I ate lunch with every week, Milton Jones. Milton is a former chairman of the Board of Regents. He was a state representative that went in the same year Jimmy Carter went into the General Assembly, and he also worked for Governor Carter in 1970. And Milton and I were talking about the power of the governor. And he says it is 100% derived from the budget. And the power is the governor's control on the budget, and the hammer is the line item.
All right. I'm sorry to cut you a little short. We got to get another break in. Tom Faust is giving me dagger looks. So let's do that, and when we come back, we'll have our last segment from here in Columbus, Georgia. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. State Senator Josh McCoon, Chuck Williams of the Columbus Ledger, a longtime, longest-serving member of the Georgia House, Calvin Smyrie, and Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson with us on the show live tonight from Columbus, Georgia. But if you're listening on the radio, it's Friday afternoon. But you can keep that straight. All right, we got a bunch of questions from the audience that we're going to turn to. Calvin, let me come to you on this one first. Will the legislature revisit campus carry when you consider that there have been some 722 school shootings this year? Is that a possibility in the next session, depending on who the governor is?
I would hope so.
You figure if Stacey Abrams is governor, it might come up?
For sure.
But Josh McCoon, if it's a Republican legislature, would it stand a chance of being reversed?
Well, since campus carry has passed, there haven't been any incidents on Georgia public college or university campuses. And, I mean, that's the facts.
Okay.
And so I think a Republican majority would be very circumspect about revisiting
All right.
that issue.
We do try for respectful conversation on Political Rewind. Thank you.
Bill, can I speak?
Yeah, speak.
Yeah, it's going to depend on this election and how many of these women come out and vote and send a message. I will say campus carry everywhere, and one other bill, but those two in particular, it very much encourage you to put your gun in your car.
All right.
And that is, I think women don't like that because they get stolen there, then they end up in the hands of criminals.
Thank you. Chuck, Casey Cagle has pointed out he's attacked, the Republicans are attacking Abrams over her debt, ignoring Nathan Deal's debt that was far greater than Abrams. Is that a fair tactic or not? Well, everything is fair in politics, but it's also true, right?
I mean, it is true, and I think it will be. As a journalist, this issue is really going to be interesting to me because it sets up a question of double standard. And I think you've got to look at it very hard. I mean, I know it's something, if I were covering the governor's race, I would be asking a lot of questions about and looking at the comparison to it. Because I think it is an issue that does warrant being looked at.
All right. Calvin, are Georgia teachers going to be a big political force in this election? You talked about them. We talked about them a little bit before.
Always. Yeah. Teachers are well-respected. And when you think about a teacher, you think about not only a spouse, but relatives, the kids in the classroom. They all have parents. So teachers are well-respected, and I think they will always have some impact on our election.
Thank you. Teresa, I'll start with you. What does the panel think about legalized gambling in Georgia? I assume that starts with casinos. What do you think about that, Mayor? Do you want casinos in Columbus?
Well, I'll say this. We've actually looked into that because we would be one of the cities. We hope we certainly don't want to be left out. I think the big issue is that it has to be more than something that's just gambling. We're hoping that, of course, a convention hotel is connected to it. We're hoping that the state will put some requirements in that allow it, require it to be a little bit broader than just the gambling, so it will actually be an economic engine and stimulus, and also take into consideration our locally owned restaurants and entertainment facilities so it doesn't drain from the market but adds to the market.
Josh, the Supreme Court says sports gambling is now legal. Are we going to see casinos, and would you fight it with every last breath?
I've been on record being opposed to any expansion of gambling in our state. If you look at states that have passed casino gaming, whether that's table games or just slot machines, what you see is that the percentage of household unsecured debt increases. You have both criminal and real economic issues affecting folks at the lowest tier of our society. And so I think we have to be very, very circumspect about expanding gambling.
I want to ask a gambling question to Calvin and Josh because of their General Assembly stuff. I mean, if you look, we gamble in Georgia right now. We have a lottery, and a lot of our kids have benefited from that lottery. If you look, you know there is illegal sports wagering going on in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, Tennessee. If those dollars could be captured and somebody could walk in and take the Falcons and 7 points against New England, probably would lose the bet. But if they could walk in on a Sunday and make that bet and the state gets money off of that and kids go to college, is that a bad thing?
Calvin, we got about a minute and a half.
Well, I don't know what politicians are feared of when there's a referendum. Let the people speak. That's what we don't want. We don't want the people to have a say, so let the people decide, and that's what it does.
Can I speak to that?
Yeah, sure.
So in a referendum campaign in Georgia, who's going to have the money to run that campaign? The truth of the matter is the casino industry, which is desperate to expand its marketplace, has access to unlimited funds for the purpose of a referendum campaign. The folks who want to raise significant and serious public policy questions about it can't begin to match that.
If we had made that argument relative in 1989 and 1992, we wouldn't have a Hope Scholarship.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have a lottery.
And I don't feel sorry for the conservative PACs. They got plenty of money. They'll be speaking.
Well, no, but wait. So this is interesting because, Chuck, what I hear Josh McCoon saying is because the casino forces can bring so much money to the table, he wants the legislature to stop it before it even gets to the voters out there. But couldn't you make the same argument about the amount of money that goes into a gubernatorial race? Or, in other words, money is always going to be an issue. Why is it different with casinos?
Money is the grease. Yeah. I mean, and...
Yeah, so, I mean, I share that concern. Having just gone through a statewide campaign in Georgia, I can tell you that it's very disconcerting that the person that's able to gather in the most money is typically the person that winds up in first place. And the question is, how many public policy decisions do you want made by direct democracy versus the representatives that have been elected to represent their districts? And I will say there's a qualitative difference between people playing the lottery and people playing the sports books and playing table games at a casino. Those are two very different things.
I am down to the last minute, and I said something in the opening I've got to get to at least for a second or two. Teresa Tomlinson, Scott Pruitt loves Chick-fil-A. What the heck is wrong with that?
What was it Joni Ernst said? He's the swampiest thing in D.C.
Scott Pruitt.
He is a corruption personified.
But he loves Chick-fil-A. Yeah. He just wants his wife to have a franchise, Chuck.
Hey, anybody in their right mind would want a Chick-fil-A franchise.
Right.
Last year, one opened in North Columbus. It was, the fourth or fifth one in the county. They bought an existing piece of land at Columbus Park Crossing and paid $3 million for 1 acre. It's the most expensive acre in this city's history. So I can understand why he would want his wife.
Serious value for his wife.
I have got to call an end to the show because we are just about out of time. I have just enough time to say thank you, Senator, Josh McCoon for being with us. Thank you, Chuck Williams. It was great to have you. You need to do this more often. We'd love to have you back, too. State Representative Calvin Smyrie, you and I have known each other for 30-plus years, and it's always been wonderful to get a chance to hear what's on your mind. Thank you for joining us. And Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, a lame duck. Out of here when? When is your term end?
My last day is January 6th, 2019, and Mayor-elect Henderson will be sworn in on the 7th at 9 a.m.
And I wanted to point out that we didn't ask a single question about what Teresa Tomlinson wants to do with her political future. That's, you can do that. All right. My thanks to all of you here in Columbus. Once again, I want to say we're very excited about the fact that in just a matter of weeks, Political Rewind will expand once again. And starting on July 23rd, we hope you will join us on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 2 o'clock to hear what we think has become just one of the most interesting political shows on the air today. And I hope you all agree with that. So thank you for helping support the show. Again, our thanks to the River Center for being such gracious hosts. It's been wonderful to be in your facility. I did see that Seth Rudesky is bringing his big fat Broadway to the River City in about a month. And if you've never seen Seth and you like Broadway musicals, you should come to that show if there are any tickets left. That's it for us. Political Rewind will be back on Monday. If you don't hear us on the radio on Monday, you can always subscribe to our podcast or go to our website and hear us there. Thanks again for everybody's presence tonight. Thank you, Columbus. We love being with you. That's our show from Columbus. Right before we went on the air, the story about Casey Cagle supporting a major Senate bill to hurt GOP primary opponent Hunter Hill broke in the AJC and on Channel 2. We'll cover that story in depth on Monday's edition of Rewind Live at 2.